In fact, I have seen a classified document that says that, as of 1990 when I saw that document, they had 42 separate full-time, full-paid Central Intelligence Agency, NSA, and military intelligence officers on the payroll of the top 10 major news media outlets in the United States whose job it was to keep any national security information from being published. So I know that's true, and I've talked to them right across the table. And they've acknowledged to me that that's what they are and that's what they do, because they spiked one of the stories we had during the Iran-Contra thing. Time magazine had a guy who was a full-time Central Intelligence Agency operative. The true free press thing is a self-constructed myth. Keith Schneider, reporter for the New York Times during the Iran-Contra events, gave all the data to them, the tail numbers on the airplanes, the drug smuggling operations, everything that they were doing. Keith Schneider told me personally, "You know, Dan, we at the New York Times have very good sources inside the intelligence community." And I said, "Yes, Keith. You're talking to the guy who was general counsel for the Times. We're the ones who got the affidavits from Teddy Sorensen." He said, "Well, frankly, our sources in the intelligence community won't confirm your story, so the New York Times won't print it." That's the type of free press you've got in the United States right now. Dot. Testimonial. John Callahan, former division chief of the Accidents and Investigations Branch of the FAR in Washington, D.C. This incident took place in 1986 and began with a phone call from the people in Alaska. He says, "We got a problem here, the whole office is full of media and I don't know what to tell them. Last week we had a UFO chase a 747 across the skies up here for about 30 minutes or so. Apparently, the word got out and we have all these news people here and we want to know what to tell them." Being an old government employee, I told him what you always tell him, that it's under investigation and then get all the data together. I told him I wanted all the discs and tapes they had available flown overnight to the FAR, tech center in Atlantic City. They called the military and they told them they wanted all their tapes. The FAR controls all the airspace above the United States and its territory. It doesn't belong to the military, the guys shooting the rockets off. It belongs to the United States government and it is controlled by the FAR. The military said they were short on their tapes and they had to put them back in service. I thought it was mysterious that the military tapes disappeared. It wasn't right. We went from 30 days to 15 days for the time period required to keep radar tapes, and the first indication makes it look like the military knew more than we did about who the visitors were and they didn't want anybody else to know. And of course, the people that are involved at the lower levels don't really know what is going on above them. When someone calls up and says put those tapes back in service, they just put them back in service. They really don't care. The FAR administrator sent my boss, who was the associate director of the FAR, and me to Atlantic City to look at this thing to see if he had something to worry about. It took us 2 days to look at all the data. We went in and told him we wanted this room set up to be just like it was in Anchorage during the encounter, and we wanted all that data to come to this radar scope so we could see and hear everything the controller saw. Some of the people that were working on that side of the fence and who were displaying this, had already reviewed the tapes, and they didn't feel comfortable showing us what was on there. But we looked at all of it. The Japanese airline 747 was coming from the northwest across Alaskan territory at an altitude between 31,000 and 35,000 feet. It was around 11 o'clock at night. The pilot had asked the controller if there was any traffic at his altitude. And the controller said, no. The pilot replied that he had a target at his 11 o'clock or 1 o'clock position about 8 miles away. Now in the 747 they have radar in the nose that picks up the weather, so his radar was picking up a large target. The pilot saw the target with his eyes. And the target, the way he described it, was a huge ball with lights running around it, four times the size of the 747. The military controller said, I see him 35 miles north of Anchorage. Who's that at 11 o'clock or 1 o'clock in his position? The FAR controller said, I don't have anybody, parenthesis, any regular traffic. Do you have anybody? The military controller said, it's not mine, all our traffic is on the west side. A couple of times during the operation, the Japanese pilot would say, he's now at 11 o'clock, he's now at 1 o'clock, he's now at 3 o'clock. The UFO was bouncing around the 747. When he would say that, the military controller would cut in and confirm the position. The military controller has height-finding radar, and they have long-range radar and short-range radar. So if they don't catch it on one of their systems, they catch it on the other. If you listen to the military controller, at one time he said, I have it on the height radar, or my range radar, which indicated that they had a target on his system. Well, this went on for 31 minutes. The UFO would be in one position or the other following the Japanese 747. After a while they changed his altitude and it still stayed with him. They gave him a 360, parenthesis, turn. When you are a 747 and you make a 360, it takes you a few minutes to turn around. You cover a lot of space. And it still stayed with him. It was either in the front, on the side, or behind him. They would see it at 1 o'clock, 7 or 8 miles in front of the 747. And then on the next sweep, parenthesis, 10 seconds later, it would be behind him, 7 or 8 miles. It always stayed 7 or 8 miles away from the target, parenthesis, note the familiar nonlinear maneuvers of this UFO, covering many miles in less than 10 seconds. This is corroborated by dozens of other UFO radar events in the testimony of many other witnesses. See the book Disclosure, Military and Government Witnesses Reveal the Greatest Secrets in Modern History by Stephen M. Greer. And witness testimony at www.youtube.com/user/disclosure-sg. At the end, when the Japanese 747 was leaving the airspace, there was a United Airlines flight coming up to land in Alaska. The controller told the United pilot that the Japanese 747 was being chased by a UFO and he'd like to leave him at that altitude to check him out. The United pilot said, fine, sure. So they gave him a left turn, 20 degrees or so, kept him at his altitude and they kind of ran him in toward the Japanese 747. Once the two airplanes passed, the UFO followed the United, parenthesis, flight, down through the airspace until its final approach, and then the UFO just disappeared. When they read the report, the FAR decided it had to protect itself. You can't say you saw a target, even though this is what he said. So they made him change his report to say position symbols, which makes it sound like it wasn't really a target. Well, if it's not a target, then a lot of the other position symbols that we are separating on radar aren't targets either. And when I read that, I thought, oh, there is something fishy here. Either somebody is worried about something, or they are trying to cover something up. We returned to Washington the next day. The FAR administrator called down and wanted to know if he had a problem or not. My boss told him, we took video of it and it looks like there might have been something there. The FAR administrator asked us to come up and present a quick 5-minute rundown of what happened. So headed upstairs to the 10th floor of FAR headquarters in Washington, D.C. and gave a 5-minute debriefing for the administrator, who was at the time Admiral Engine. He wanted to watch the video, so we plugged it in for him. After about 5 minutes he told his staff to cancel his meetings. Then he watched the rest. Just over a half an hour. When it was over, the Admiral asked us what we thought. My boss gave a good political answer and he said he wasn't sure what it was. The Admiral told us not to talk to anybody until he gave us the okay. Then the next day I got a call from someone with the scientific study group, from either President Reagan or the CIA, who had questions about the incident. I said, I don't know what you are talking about, You probably want to call Admiral Anjan. A few minutes later the Admiral called down to let us know he had set up a briefing for the next morning at 9 o'clock in the round room, and to bring all the stuff we had and give them whatever they wanted. Essentially, the FAR wanted to get out of it. So I brought up all the people from the tech center, who had all kinds of boxes of data that we had them print out enough to fill the room. They brought in 3 people from the FBI, 3 people from the CIA, and 3 people from Reagan's scientific study team. I don't know who the rest of the people were, but they were all excited. We let them watch the video. Then they had all kinds of questions about the frequency, the rate of the antennae turning, how many radars and antennas, how did the data get processed. They were all excited. This being the first time they ever had 30 minutes of radar data on a UFO. When they asked me what I thought, I told them that it looked like we had a UFO that was up there. The reason it wasn't consistently on the FAR's tapes was because it was too large of an aircraft, and it was picked up as weather, so we wouldn't record it. The system is programmed to filter out such things. The Japanese pilot did see it and even drew pictures of it. They eventually gave him a hard time because of what he said, that he was embarrassing his country. When they got done, the guy from the CIA made all these other guys in the swear that this never took place. We never had this meeting. And this was never recorded. He said if they came out and told the American public that they ran into a UFO out there, it would cause panic across the country. The group took that data, only I had the original video and the pilot's report that came through, along with the FAR's first report. It was all downstairs on my table. They didn't ask for that, so I didn't give it to them. And later on when I retired, that was the stuff that was in my office and all that came with me. And we've been sitting on it ever since. Parenthesis, we have obtained all of these materials, including the radar video, ATC voice transcripts, the FAR report, and the computer printouts of the event. The tragedy of this JAL 747 pilot is a poignant reminder of the power of ridicule in keeping this subject secret. The pilot was forced to take a desk job for a prolonged period and was humiliated. SG. Our military controllers said they had seen it. Our FAR controllers said they had seen it. After a period of time, the FAR controllers changed their story and said they really didn't see a target, that they saw something else, which makes it sound like somebody is helping them fill out their reports. But who do you tell that you were involved in a UFO incident without them looking at you like you aren't wrapped too tight? This is the way our country is set up. The only ones who see a UFO in the TV programs are the rednecks out in the country that are going coon hunting or alligator hunting at night. If you talk about seeing a UFO, you are putting yourself in a funny kind of category. That's probably one of the reasons why you don't hear about it anymore. But as far as I'm concerned, I saw a UFO chase a Japanese 747 across the sky for over half an hour on radar. And it's faster than anything that I know of in our government. The senior NCO at NORAD, North American Air Defense Command, knows about it. He pulled me to the side and said so. I insisted there has to be a report filed or something. He told me there is a report that you can file. It's about an inch thick, and the first 2 pages are about the sighting. The rest of it is basically a psychological profile of you, your family, your bloodlines, everything. When the Air Force goes through it, they can discredit you completely by either saying that you were on drugs, or your mother was a communist, or anything to discredit you. You'd never get a promotion, and you'd spend the next 3.5 years up at the North Pole, living in a tent, checking the weather balloons with no hope for promotion. So, the message was pretty loud and clear: you just shut up and don't say anything to anybody. Parenthesis, see. Dot. Testimonial. Major George A. Filer III was an Air Force intelligence officer. He was a navigator in various aircraft and tanker transport aircraft and frequently briefed generals and congressmen on our capabilities and the threat to U.S. forces. I had personally never seen any UFOs until about 1962, when we were flying tankers over England, and London Control asked us to intercept one of these craft. We happened to be done with our refueling mission, and we accepted the assignment. We were just over the North Sea, and they asked us to fly to the center of England. We were doing 400 plus miles an hour in a dive down to intercept this object. They gave us headings, and it was pretty much hovering in the Oxford to the Stonehenge area, at 20 to 30 miles out. I got it on radar, and it was a very large return. We used to fly up by the Forth Bridge over the Firth of Forth. The bridge was kind of like the San Francisco Bridge. It is a very large bridge, and the return of the UFO was similar to that in size and intensity. In other words, it was a very large radar return. Obviously, London Control had it on their radar, and they were vectoring us to this object. When we got about a mile from the UFO, it just took off into space. Several thousand miles an hour, almost directly up. Frankly, at least to my knowledge, we had nothing like that capability. My best guess is that it was a disc-type craft, but a flat disc. At least, there were lights something like this at the top and at the bottom. It was more than just a straight plate-like object, it had a dome on the top of it. If the radar return was accurate, it was probably 500 yards across in size, or something. I mean, it was a huge thing. We wrote it in the navigator's log. I also had a sighting here, where we live. This is Briarwood Lake in Medford, New Jersey. We had just moved into this house. I'm guessing it was 3 o'clock in the morning. I was asleep with my wife when suddenly the room got very bright in the middle of the night. I got up out of bed and opened up the shade and looked outside at the lake. I don't know if most people have seen a submarine surfacing with all the water coming up. Well, this was like a disc about 30 feet in diameter surfacing, and what looked to me like water coming off of it. Around the craft was this ionization. Very similar to the Aurora Borealis. It moved across the lake for a while, and then flew off at a fairly high rate of speed. Because of that, I have checked with a lot of the neighbors, and it's amazing how many people have actually seen craft on these lakes. Also, occasionally I used to do briefings to the generals on the UFO sightings that had occurred around the world. One that sticks out in my mind is 1976. There was a famous encounter near Tehran. Around that time, this particular colonel was telling me that the F-106 had set the world's record for speed. They had these aircraft going as fast as they could, and they would be diving on this UFO that was hovering in a valley. Just like my experience in England, when they got near the craft, it took off and left them standing still. They were doing 1,500 miles per hour or something. Whatever the top speed was at that time for these aircraft in a dive. But whoever was flying these had capabilities far beyond anything that we had for years and years. I think even today. I think these are non-human craft that possess a different form of propulsion and are coming here doing reconnaissance. I've talked to a number of astronauts who have seen them, I've talked to other military pilots who have seen them. And I remember Captain Ramage, who I used to work for in Athens, Greece. He had one during the Korean War fly right off his wing, stay with him for an hour. Not only off his wing, but doing acrobatic things around his aircraft. I don't know the exact percentage of people, but something like 10% of the pilots and air crews that you ask have had sightings. I sat in this room here a few years ago, and a colonel who was in intelligence told me that his entire B-52 crew saw a UFO. You know, these people don't volunteer and sit in front of the camera and tell about it, but there are an awful lot of people who have seen them. I think that it's time that these various programs come out. The way that it's been kept secret is through ridicule. You will hear someone telling a story like this, and people will say, well, he must be crazy. He believes in UFOs. And, they brought this ridicule out when anyone saw anything, but my experience has been an awful lot of policemen have seen these, an awful lot of FBI have seen these, an awful lot of military personnel have seen these. At times I used to transport nuclear weapons. In other words, I was mentally fit to carry nukes, but I'm not mentally fit if I report seeing a UFO. Dot. Testimonial. Dr. Robert Wood, McDonnell Douglas Aerospace Engineer. I have a degree in aeronautical engineering from the University of Colorado, and I subsequently got a PhD in physics from Cornell. I went right into McDonnell Douglas as a young engineer and stayed there for 43 years and wound up in charge of various aspects of our research and development programs, including the last one, which was the space station. In the late 1960s, there was quite a bit of publicly exposed information about UFO events. One day my boss told me General Schriever, the guy who invented the ICBM, was retiring and the Air Force wanted to have sort of a symposium for him. Each of the contractors, including us, received an assignment to predict what the future would hold over the next 10 years. Our assignment was to talk about going to space and back. I knew my boss was really oriented toward nuclear propulsion, and everybody was tired of hearing about it, so I said, "G-Ray, why don't you tell them about how the UFOs allegedly do it?" He loved the idea and asked me to work on it. I became interested in subscribing to the various journals and met Jim McDonald. He convinced me that I had a story that I could tell to my management, since I had concluded that the UFOs were real. One day when I was driving to work, I said, "There's no other solution. They're clearly real, they're clearly extraterrestrial, and they work somehow. I think we ought to figure out how they work, because I wouldn't want to be the last aerospace company to discover gravity control. I think we ought to be the first." I took a briefing to my management, who were very supportive. I was offered a very modest project to look into this problem, so we did some things like seeing whether we could change the speed of light via a large magnetic field. The classified program I was working on was at the code word level, and it had to do with our ballistic missile defense program. It's very common for intelligence agencies like the CIA to ask contractors who have an expertise in one area to study the enemy's expertise in that same area. So this program was to study the Soviet ballistic missile defense program. And you had access to special libraries, so one of the things that we could do is go up to the library that the Air Force ran and sort of pour through top secret material. When I had to use their library, I'd see what they had on UFOs. For about a year I was getting quite a few hits on the subject from various reports. Then one day the entire UFO subject just vanished. The librarian in our group that I was working with said he'd been in that vault for 20 years and had never an entire subject just vanish. I was encouraged to go see the Condon Committee and tell them what we were doing. So I wrote them a nice letter saying that our company had been looking into the subject of UFOs, and did they want to hear what we were doing? I got a courteous invitation back from Condon. We prepared a briefing that explained how you could take a loop of superconducting material and establish a strong magnetic field in one direction, and then charge it at the same time, so it could float in the electrostatic field of the Earth. The bottom line was that we were just about a factor of 10 away from having superconducting current capacity enough to do this. Of course, our team thought, gee, only a factor of 10. We're going to be there in a couple of years. Condon's lack of interest in this subject was quite in contrast to his own group. He called his group together, who sat around and listened to our briefing. When he said, "Therefore you can't do it," they all looked at him in amazement and said, "But it's only a factor of 10. So I became friendly with several of them, Roy Craig and a couple of the others. I concluded that this Condon committee was not an objective study. I wrote a letter to Condon suggesting that it might be helpful if he were to establish his group in two parts, and have one of believers and one of disbelievers, and let both of them go to work with their angles. I said, "I am taking the liberty of sending a copy of this letter to every member of your group, whose addresses I had received from them privately." He was so furious that he called up James S. McDonnell, who was at that time the chairman of the newly merged Douglas and McDonnell aircraft companies, and tried to get me fired. Regarding Jim McDonald, I liked the guy. He was really an energetic physicist and wouldn't let any grass grow under his feet. Once, when I was traveling through Tucson where he lived, I had a 2-hour layover and he came out to the airport to have a beer with me. He said, "The ATs, I think I've got it." I said, "What do you think you got?" He said, "I think I got the answer, but I can't tell you yet. I have got to be sure." It was 6 weeks after that he tried to shoot himself. A couple months after that he finally died. Knowing what I do about the persuasive skills of our counterintelligence people, I think we had the capacity to convince him to do it himself. I think that's what happened. Dot. Testimonial. Michael Schrutt, military aerospace historian. When you go to a supermarket checkout and there is a rack of UFO stories in the tabloids, what you may be reading there are stories of actual events. Only when it is portrayed through the tabloids it gets discredited. This has worked for 50 years, why would they change it now? Many of the reports that cannot be explained have come from intelligent and technically well-qualified individuals whose integrity cannot be doubted. In addition, the reports received officially by the Air Force include only a fraction of the spectacular reports which are publicized by many private UFO organizations. Major General Ebela Bailey, Director of Information, Office of the Secretary of the Air Force Unidentified Flying Objects, Number 55, Hearing by Committee on Armed Services, House of Representatives, April 5, 1966. I am convinced that UFOs exist because I've seen one. Dot. It was the darndest thing I've ever seen. It was big, it was very bright, it changed colors and it was about the size of the moon. We watched it for 10 minutes, but none of us could figure out what it was. One thing's for sure, I'll never make fun of people who say they've seen unidentified objects in the sky. President Jimmy Carter UFO Secret File Military Sightings 1961-1997 Documents, CIA Document. Marilyn Monroe Wiretap. August 3, 1962. Testimonials, Michael Smith, U.S. Air Force Radar Controller Sergeant Clifford Stone, U.S. Army Retrieval Unit Nick Pope, British Ministry of Defense Larry Warren, Security Officer at Bentwaters Air Force Base in the United Kingdom Lord Hill Norton, former head of the British Ministry of Defense Daniel Sheehan, Attorney Lance Corporal, Marine, John Weygandt. Commentary from Stephen M. Greer. John F. Kennedy had a lot on his plate during his abbreviated term as president. He had the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he knew the U.S. intelligence organizations needed to be reined in, including the Black Ops group controlling the UFO and ET issues. Jack Kennedy intended to shrink the military-industrial complex, end the Cold War, and make peace with the Soviet Union. He wanted to pull out of Vietnam and had plans to virtually dissolve the CIA, who were involved in some nefarious plots, including the sale of narcotics. And yes, JFK also wanted the UFO matter disclosed. The fascist empire lurking in America's shadows was not about to allow that to happen. Their first target, however, would be the president's mistress. Through my work, I've established some deep contacts within the intelligence and national security communities. A few senior NSA people have given me documents over the years for safekeeping. One of these includes an oversized Xerox copy of a 1962 wiretap transcription which bears the code names, Project Moondust and Project 46. The original, which is classified top secret, has not been declassified. It was given to me so I could get it to the right people. This document was a wiretap transcription summary of Marilyn Monroe. It is dated the day before the night they found the actress dead. I've included a retyped transcription and a copy of the Xerox document in this file. As you can see, the conversation describes how Miss Monroe, who had recently been jilted by the Kennedy brothers and was upset and hurt, called Robert Kennedy and a socialite in New York, an art dealer friend of hers, stating that she was going to set up a press conference and tell the public what Jack Kennedy had told her regarding objects from outer space that had crashed and been retrieved in New Mexico in the 1940s. President Kennedy had obviously confided this information to her, having seen the AT craft and debris from the UFO crash. After receiving the document, I located someone who was with the Los Angeles Police Department intelligence unit that helped facilitate the wiretapping and monitoring up to the time of Marilyn Monroe's death and knew how the actress was really killed. There is no doubt that she was murdered by cutout agents of the U.S. intelligence community.